You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hello and welcome to What You Missed This Week. I'm Joe Weisenthal. This is the new podcast that has the best and most interesting interviews from the Daily Market Close Show that I co-anchor with Scarlett Fu and Julia Chatterley on Bloomberg Television, called What You Miss. Our aim is to take you beyond the headlines and bring you unique perspectives on the week's top stories and, well, those that you may have just missed. We hope the podcast is the perfect way to kick off your weekend. First off, we spoke with David Kirkpatrick, author of The Facebook Effect and founder and CEO of Techonomy, about Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's 2 days of congressional testimony. David said Zuckerberg did solve more problems than he created. Take a listen.
David, explain to us where our data's going and how it's spread.
I wish I could fully explain where all of our data's going. I think actually one of the healthiest things that's come out of these hearings is that more average Americans are being forced to realize that this is all about their data, and that's what they should have known all along. There is a reason why these services are free, and it's not necessarily a horrible thing, but you shouldn't go into it unawares. And I thought it was very interesting also how many of the congresspeople were holding up user agreements and asking him whether he thought people really read them. And he was acting like people really do kind of read them, which is, of course, totally wrong, as all the senators and congressmen were saying.
Well, we learned they're longer than the U.S. Constitution yesterday.
Yeah, very long. I think the general view is that he did fine. I mean, the stock is up. There were no major gaffes that are going to be replayed and replayed. But in the questioning that you heard, and when you go back, are there going to be areas that you sense, okay, this could down the road start to emerge as the germ of a problem that could still face the company?
Well, I think he solved more problems than he created. I mean, I don't think he solved any, but he certainly addressed problems and made progress on problems. I think he did do an excellent job on balance. He certainly showed he had stamina, and he was generally unflappable, faced with some extremely hostile questions, yes, especially today. I mean, certainly his willingness to accept regulation, which he repeated over and over again, and even yesterday at one point promised to provide a list of regulations that he was willing to have Facebook abide by, that is going to come back. And whether you call it haunting him or simply affecting him, I don't know. But that's going to change the terms under which Facebook operates in American society.
But what he wasn't willing to do was change the business model of the company. For instance, there are a lot of questions about opting in rather than opting out. And of course, we know for Facebook, the easier Facebook makes it for people to opt out, the less profitable its advertising business is. Walk us through a little bit here about how Facebook really makes its money. Does it make money on users who have the lowest privacy settings, who just have make data available to everyone, or does it just need the most number of users? Is it volume or value here?
I would say on balance, it makes money, the most money off the wealthiest users, because it knows exactly who we all are, where we live, what we have, what we do, and the ads are more expensive if they go to, you know, affluent women who live in Manhattan who work in television. I mean,
Julia,
they could target that. They could target that, by the way. So, you know, that's going to be an expensive ad. You know, you can actually advertise to one individual if you try hard enough on Facebook. That has been done in the past. I think it's still possible. So the point is, targeting is what it's all about. The more data they have on you, the more they can target you. Zuckerberg continually presents that as a virtue, not a negative, because he says that allows the ads to be more relevant, which is a inverse of that they allows the ads to be more profitable for Facebook.
When I first got targeted by advertising, I was horrified. And then I was like, actually, it's quite useful to me. I kind of got over my initial that I've been caught out doing something. I'm just not sure how much users ultimately care. Hashtag delete Facebook really didn't get going.
Well, Julia, you're right. Users really don't care, I'm afraid.
We also spoke with George Magnus, China Center Associate at the University of Oxford, about the worry of weaponizing finance between the U.S. and China.
Well, I think if you say at this moment, I think the answer is no. In fact, I read the story along with probably hundreds of thousands of other people today on Bloomberg, and I wasn't convinced by it, to be honest. I think at this point, particularly after the lessons which I think the Chinese learned in 2015 and 2016, they would be really anxious about using the messaging of a currency depreciation or using the currency as a weapon in this trade spat with the United States, because I think they would worry that it would engender financial instability at home and also encourage the inventiveness of Chinese companies and Chinese households to get their money out of China, despite the fact that, of course, they have capital controls. But that hasn't stopped people in the past. So I think I wouldn't discount it completely. I mean, in the event of a complete breakdown of relations, of course, you know, all gloves will be off. But I think at this point, no, I don't buy that story, to be honest.
George, do you feel similarly about the idea that perhaps China at some point would reduce its U.S. Treasury holdings? Is the analysis similar, or are there moves that it could make there that could have some effect that wouldn't be so self-damaging?
Yeah, you know, we've been through this quite a few times in the last 10 or 15 years about whether China might, sell treasuries as a kind of to weaponize, you know, its armory against the United States. I mean, we have to just think about this, actually, because during 2015-16, when China was going through financial turbulence, basically their foreign reserves, most of which are in dollars, you know, declined by about $1 trillion. Without really threatening or moving the treasury market. And Japan has basically reduced its holdings of, or diversified its holdings of treasuries too, without really moving the market. So I also feel that the narrative, which is that China can kind of weaponize finance in order to hit back at the United States, is actually both counterproductive for China, because obviously if prices in treasury assets fall, then the Chinese themselves will actually suffer losses as well. So I think there are other things the Chinese can do, because they've used kind of pressure on companies and governments before against Norway, the Philippines, Japan, South Korea. So I think there are other things they can do before they even get to this kind of Armageddon type of scenario where they're, you know, as a last resort, they might use finance.
All right, so as we watch China and the U.S. trade tit for tat and ratchet up these tensions and threats of a trade war, you've laid out three distinct possibilities. What is the most likely outcome?
Well, you know, I think we're all guessing here. I mean, there is still a possibility, I suppose, that there will be a fudge. I mean, I think everybody knows that within the next either tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, President Xi Jinping is going to appear at the Bao Forum, which is this big kind of Davos type event they have in Hainan, on the island of Hainan in China. And it's widely expected, you know, he's going to make a very important speech. You know, China will not back down in the face of U.S. pressure, and President Trump doesn't seem like, you know, he's going to back down unless he can actually has something to show for it. So there's a possibility that in the next 30 to 60 days, maybe, that there could still be a fudge. I don't think there'll be a solution, because I think the underlying conflict between the U.S. and China, you know, ostensibly it's about trade, but fundamentally it's about technology and it's about industrial policy in China. So that's not going to be resolved by, you know, changing a few tariffs or opening markets to American financial firms, although these may be part of a fudge that I think, you know, is still possible. But I do think, you know, markets are still a bit complacent. I think we have to be prepared for the possibility that actually things will get much trickier, much nastier, before they might get a little bit kind of stable, let's put it like that.
I mean, the fudge requires some level of communication and negotiation, surely. I mean, we had the Chinese Commerce Ministry saying that trade talks cannot be held under current conditions. So what's the risk here, George? And it kind of alludes to your point of perhaps the underappreciated risk here is that the Chinese just get pushed to such an extent that they go, you know what, we've battened down the hatches, we're not going to negotiate with you. And President Trump, you've got an election to win in a few months' time, and we don't have to worry about that ever again.
That's quite true. I mean, there is that political leverage that the Chinese certainly have, and it's important from a timing point of view, obviously, from a political point of view, for the president to, you know, to basically come up with something during the next few months. But I think, I think that there's a it's a very, very kind of risky situation. I don't think China wants a trade war. I don't. Although they say there aren't any kind of negotiations or trade talks going on, I can't believe that back channels aren't really working. I know that in the so-called comprehensive economic dialogue, which took place last summer, that there was a lot of disappointment about the state of negotiations and the infrastructure of dialogue between the U.S. and China, and probably things are not working as they used to. But I'm not sure that it's true that, you know, that there's been a complete kind of breakdown of communications, notwithstanding what I think the Commerce Ministry or the Finance Ministry in Beijing said other day.
George, real quickly, there's this emerging narrative out there that, you know, Trump has the next election to worry about and Xi Jinping basically has forever, so he can play the long game. Is China really able to be much slower and strategic and deliberative, or is that sort of a myth?
I think it's a bit of a myth. I mean, we all think that, it's part of the narrative that that China itself likes to encourage, which is, you know, they've been around for 5,000 years and they take the long view and so on and so forth. But actually, if that was true, then, you know, then China would never have run into any kind of financial or economic kind of turbulence during the last 20 years. And of course, that's been patently untrue. It keeps on running into trouble when it kind of makes errors, and it does make errors from time to time. So I think that view that China can sit back and take the long view is a nice part of a story, but actually I don't think it really holds much water, to be honest.
And finally, we spoke to Alberto Ramos, Goldman Sachs head of LATAM economics. He joined us to talk about what's ahead for Brazil and Mexico. Alberto discussed how the asset gains we've seen so far could be compromised or reversed.
This is day and night versus the macroeconomic reality we were facing a couple of years ago. You know, we conquered inflation. We are now living under low inflation, low rates, going through the initial iterations of a cyclical recovery. The current account has adjusted significantly. The external funding needs are rather modest, but there is a missing leg in all of that. We need to see faster and deeper progress towards fiscal adjustment. That is the complex fiscal legacy you're leaving for the next administration. The issue is urgent. It's unavoidable. The next government needs, without losing too much time, to deal with the fiscal issues that could eventually lead to a reversal of all those macroeconomic gains we have seen so far.
Is that understood, do you think?
To a certain extent, yes. The current administration did not move that much towards fiscal consolidation, but they tried hard. But the political equilibrium was such that it was difficult to co-opt large segments of Congress into supporting some of these fiscal adjustment measures, namely critical Social Security reform that will be part of the pending agenda for the next administration.
At the same time, when you look at the Brazilian stock market performance, it's been pretty spectacular. It's up about 30%, more than 30%. Over the past year, sideways more so this year thus far. Do you think that those various measures are necessary, that we need to get past this election in order for that a next leg up to happen?
They are critically necessary. Certainly the stock market has recorded significant gains over the last year or so, coming from a very low depressed base. We see now the initial signs that the business cycle is firming. Rates are low. So when you look at the outlook for equities in general, it's still somewhat supportive. The external environment also played a role in supporting local equities. But again, all these asset price gains we have seen so far and macroeconomic rebound balancing gains we have seen so far can be compromised, eventually even reversed, if we don't advance towards the fiscal consolidation. Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, we've also seen the real weaken. It's at its weakest since, I think, March of last year. How much just sort of election uncertainty is still residual in the market that if there were a outcome that was sort of benign to most investors would lift assets and bring money back into Brazil?
It's certainly a possibility that we're 6 months away from a very complex election. You know, the field of candidates is still very undefined. Investors, there aren't, they have that much visibility into that election. You know, today has been a rather chaotic day and somewhat hectic. So political noise, political uncertainty, policy uncertainty is still quite high. You know, when you're getting closer and closer to that election, the field of candidates, it's very fragmented, so we don't really know well what would be, you know, the policy mix that will come with the next administration.
I have to point out as well, coming to the end of an easing cycle as well for the central bank here too, probably quite critical.
And speaking of political uncertainty, we've got some here in the United States as well. And as a, sort of an effect of that, we perhaps have handed Brazil a gift in the form of a bigger market for its soybeans, if there's going to potentially, if there's going to be a smaller one from the United States. Of course, it's still an if.
Right. Yeah.
How big of a help for Brazil will that be if indeed we see that play
out?
Somewhat
limited, I would say.
Okay.
First, because you're talking about a commodity. A commodity means it's an homogeneous good. You can actually sell everything you produce at international market clearing price. If the destination of U.S. soybeans were to change and that would drive, you know, that demand towards Brazilian soybeans, you know, the destination of the current destination for Brazilian soybeans, they will probably buy from some other source. So in India, these markets are interconnected. There's a global clearing price. That being said, Brazil is an extraordinarily closed economy to trade. Soybeans and total exports are less than 10% of GDP. That's not going to necessarily move the needle that much in terms of the macroeconomic outlook for Brazil.
Everything that you said about Brazil is kind of the equal and opposite of what's going on in Mexico right now.
Right.
And obviously we've got, in terms of the macro environment, but we've also got the added kicker of the NAFTA negotiations, the upcoming election uncertainty there too. What are you thinking as far as Mexico is concerned, and how optimistic are you, even relative to a month ago on a successful preliminary deal, let's
That's
call
right.
it, for the NAFTA?
Cautiously optimistic.
Right.
You know, certainly, you know, the macro reality is not very inspiring. You know, modest growth, high inflation, high rates, high carry, but poorly anchored currency, a friction with the dominant trading partner, the U.S., and the ongoing negotiation of NAFTA, and a very complicated election on July 1st, where the leading candidate seems to espouse a more interventionist, somewhat heterodox and populist policy approach.
How does the election interplay with Trump's reported desire to get a deal very soon? And is there anything that the current government can really agree to that would be palatable domestically?
It's certainly an issue. It seems that the three parties involved are keen on accelerating the process and reaching a preliminary agreement within the next few weeks because of the political calendar. You're going to have a presidential election July 1st in Mexico. You have the expiration of the fast-track authority in the U.S. on July the 8th, and then you have the midterm congressional elections in the U.S. in November. So they, you know, want to accelerate a little bit the process, get an agreement to see if there is any chance that the current legislature in Mexico approves the, you know, whatever deal they agreed to, because the political balance of power may change with the election coming July 1st.
NAFTA aside, you talked about how there's all kinds of things to not like about the Mexican economy. You mentioned what Brazil needs to do structurally. What does Mexico need to do structurally?
A lot. They need to find a way to elevate, you know, the domestic savings and domestic investment, increasing productivity growth, opening sectors that have been traditionally highly concentrated and oligopolized. Basically, it's market-friendly policies that are capable of marshalling both domestic and external investment.
What happens very quickly to NAFTA, a preliminary deal to NAFTA, if the risk candidate here, Obrador, actually wins the election? Very quickly.
It's a big question mark. Nobody knows. You have to ask him. You know, you may not necessarily own, you may not necessarily own, you know, whatever agreement is signed by the current
administration. We shall see.
And that's it for this episode of What You Missed This Week. You can subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. And of course, we always love positive reviews. And don't forget to tune in to What You Missed from 3:30 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday on Bloomberg TV. Thanks for listening.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.